Baruchim Abaim, ladies. We are studying today Parashat Terumah. Today's shiur will be studied the Eidu Nishmat Mor Zekini, Yosef Ben Sarah, donated by Irving and Gloria Safdie, Hashem Yishmonem V'Chayim. Our parasha discusses the construction of the Mishkan. Of course, the Mishkan was made up of many expensive furnishings, and it cost money to build the Mishkan, just like it cost money to build a synagogue. And the parashiyot talk about how the Jewish people very generously made donations towards the project. I don't think this ever happened again in history, but they collected so much money that by the end of the project, Moshe Rabbeinu had to tell the people, enough, we don't need any more funds, we've exceeded our expectation. As I said, since that day, no institution has ever come to its pledgers and said, we have enough, you don't have to give any more. Some things only happen once in history, that's one of them. In any event, the Torah tells us, take for me a donation. And I know all of you right away are bothered with the language. What do you mean, take for me a donation? To say, give a donation. You don't take a donation, you give a donation. The language of the Torah should be, v'yitinuli teruma, and you will give for me a teruma. What does it mean, v'yikon, you will take? Person gives a donation, so you give it. You don't take it, you're not getting anything back. So in order to understand the depth of this pasuk, we must really understand one of the realities of life. David HaMelech Alav HaShalom, in the chapter in Tehillim, Perek Mem Tet, said a very clear statement that cannot be misunderstood. And he writes regarding what happens to a person after his demise, after he passes on. He says, Ki lo bemoto yikach hakol, that a person cannot take everything with him. Most, if not all, of a person's assets remain behind. A person never went to a funeral and saw a hearse carrying the body with a U-Haul attached to it. A person cannot take anything with him, not his possessions, not his furnishings, not his bank account, not his home, not his clothes. As a matter of fact, the niftar is buried in the most basic of clothes. Those clothes are called tachlichim. In English, they call them shrouds. It's a white garment, it's pure. But these garments are different than all other garments. They have no pockets. And the reason is because you can't take anything with you. And therefore you don't need to have pockets. You don't need to have any storage. David HaMelech says very clear, the currency that they have in Shamayim, the legal tender, is not the currency that we use here. And therefore it's not taken, there's no use for it. However, a person's Torah and his mitzvot, that's spiritual tender, that's spiritual currency. That's the only asset that escorts a person to the Shamayim. Specifically, we talk about the mitzvah of tzedakah. You know, when a person gives charity, he thinks that he lost that money. There's some people that give 10%, some people give 20%, so that money is lost. But they once asked the great Rabbi Ben Ish-Hai, and he explained in a mashal, he said, there was a fellow, he had 10 birds on his roof, and he shot 2 birds. And he asked, how many birds does he have left on his roof now? So the students answered, 8. He said, no, you're wrong. The only birds that he has left on his roof are the 2 dead birds. The other 8 birds fly away. He said the same thing when it comes to money. Money has wings. Money flies, money comes, money goes. Money never stays in one place at one time. The world is like a wheel. It's a wheel of fortune. It's constantly turning. People that are on top, when the wheel turns, they move to the bottom. Lo alechem. And those that are on the bottom, when the wheel turns, they move to the top. Money has wings. It never stays in the same place. And we've read about very wealthy families that they went to sleep rich and they woke up poor. There were some families, the Hunter family, which was a big family in silver. They made all their riches. They went to sleep wealthy. That night the silver market crashed. They woke up, they were poor people. They had nothing left to their name. That's the wheel of fortune. That's the money that flies. It flies from one person to another person. And the Ben Ish Chai explains the only money that has no wings, the only money that's stable, that stays, that goes nowhere, is the money that you gave to charity. That money is yours. Nobody could touch that money. Nobody could take it. It belongs to you and it's yours for eternity. And he explained it on the Pasuk when it says, V'yikhu li teruma, take for me a donation. Because when you're giving charity, you're really taking it for yourself. Because you're really depositing it in your account in Shamam, and that's your money. And that's not subject to any circumstances or any economic circumstances, whether the market crashes, whether there's a tornado or natural disaster, that money, it's not FDIC insured. It's insured by God Himself. And therefore, at the end of the day, the only thing that a person can take, let's say, from his money, is the money that he gave to tzedakah. That he can take with him. That is with him. That's why it says, v'yikru li teruma, take for yourself a donation. Whenever I talk about charity to the men, so I try to put it in their brain so they can understand to get over that difficulty of giving. So I try to explain it to them. When a person goes to the bank and he makes $1,000 deposit, so he has no problem making the deposit, even though he's giving it to the teller, because he knows he's not giving it to the teller. The teller is going to take it and put it in his account and he's going to accrue interest on it. And therefore, whenever a person gives charity, you have to imagine that under your check, there's a deposit slip. And it has your name on it. And it has your bank account number in Shamayim. And the poor person or the rabbi or the institution is the bank teller. They're just taking it and they're depositing it in your account. And therefore, you're not losing anything. On the contrary, it's the only way to stash away the money. Otherwise, it has no value. They once asked one of the great wealthy Rothschilds, Baron Rothschild. The king asked him, how much is he worth? And he said, 10 or 20% of his real value. So the king said, I don't understand. We know you're worth 10 times this amount. How come you only say you're worth 10%? So he said, my dear king, you asked me what I'm worth. I'm only worth the money I gave to charity. All the other money that I have can be taken away from me at any moment. Tomorrow the king could declare confiscation, eminent domain. He could take all my money and have nothing. There's no guarantee on any money that I have, only on the money that I gave to charity. That's my worth. That's what I have. That already is insured. That's guaranteed. That already is the most stable investment. And that's what the Torah says, v'yikhu li teruma. When you're giving charity, you're actually taking for yourself and you're taking it for eternity. I once heard from the Hafetz Chaim. The Hafetz Chaim once had a question. He said, it might not be really fair that one person is rich and the other person is poor. After all, the rich man could buy his eternity. Just by giving tzedakah, he's buying a piece of Olam Haba. The poor man doesn't have that ability to buy his eternity. He doesn't have the money to buy a piece of Olam Haba. So it's really not fair if you think about it. Why should God give the rich man so much money as an opportunity to throw his money around, and now he owns Chelek L'Olam Haba. The poor man can't afford it. It's not fair. So the Hafetz Chaim said, that's why God created a special Yetzer Hara. And that's the Yetzer Hara of the rich man. And sometimes you can't believe it, but I've seen it, that people have so much money, more money than they can count, more money that they'll be able to spend, not them, not their children or grandchildren, but they have an interference, they can't give it. There's a special yetzer that goes into their brain. You can't explain it. It's such a simple thing, just take out the money, you're giving it to your own bank account. They want my money, I'm not giving it, let them go somewhere. It's a certain stinginess, a certain miserliness, and the man who doesn't have the money can't believe it. What are you going to do with all that money? You can't take it with you. But there's a special yetzer hara that the rich man has, and that evens it out. So you shouldn't think it's so easy, rich man has money. Because it was so easy, there'd be no deficit in yeshivas today. If every rich man was giving what he's supposed to give, the Am Yisrael would have a surplus. So why don't they have a surplus? Because to make it fair, God has to make the rich man, has to make it difficult for him to give. And that's why it's incumbent for the rich man to know this, that he has to overcome this yetzer hara. Because otherwise, like I said once, you know, a person on the day of his demise, all his money turns into monopoly money. There's no value of it anymore. A day before, he could have bought with a dollar, he could have bought eternity. The day, the moment of death, the dollar has no value, has zero value. He cannot buy even a piece of gum. He cannot do anything with it. And that's why it's important to a person to fulfill the mitzvah of tzedakah. You're getting. You're not only giving. That's why the word in Hebrew, venatenu. There's a Hebrew word when it says to give charity, venatenu, and you shall give. Venatenu is read forwards, venatenu, and it's read backwards, venatenu. There's certain words like that in language that you can read it forward and backwards. It's called a palindrome. And our rabbis ask, venatenu, why is it written, read both ways? And the explanation is because when you give this way, venatenu, God gives you in return. Venatenu, venatenu, it's a double giving. It's like there's two hands that are operating simultaneously. When a person gives this way, there's a hand from Shamayim that's coming and giving him back. And that's also, when you give charity, you're really getting. Because that's where the blessing comes from. And if a person shouldn't think, well, I gave $100, God will give me back $1,000 as a result of it. So you're always getting. Charity brings beracha, venatenu, venatenu. There was one person, he always would give charity, and he had so much. So somebody asked him, I don't understand. You're always giving and giving and giving, but you still have so much. How is that possible? So he said, well, you see, every time I shovel money out, God shovels money back in. But it seems God's shovel is bigger than mine. And therefore, we believe that that's where the beracha comes from. Hence, when a person gives chai, he's really taking for himself. Because that's the beracha. There was once a fellow. Our halakha says that once you try to give 10% to tzedakah, minimally. So there was a fellow, the Gemara says it. Tosafot brings it down in Masechet Ta'anit. He had a field. And the field would make 1,000 bushels a year. It's a nice business he had. And he was loyal to the mitzvah of charity. He would give 100 bushels a year to tzedakah. 10%. And his son inherited the field. And his son said, why is my father giving 100 bushels? For what purpose? I want to keep all to myself. And slowly, slowly the field started to dwindle. By the end, the field was only producing 100. So he went to the rabbis, and the rabbis explained, if you want to be a partner with God, God made a very fair partnership. God says, all I'm asking is for 10%. You can keep 90. It's a great deal. You know, it's all God's money anyway. God could have told us, I want 90 and you keep 10. We'd have to listen. We can argue with Hashem. But he said, if you want me to be 50-50 with you, I don't even want 50. Just give me 10 and you keep 90. La-beracha. But God says, when you keep everything for yourself, then I take back 90 and you become the partner of 10%. So if you want to remain the lion's share partner, just I'm asking for 10. You don't even want to give 10? Now you become the 10%. You take my place. You become the 10% partner. I take the 90. And that's what happened to that son that stopped giving the mitzvah of tzedakah. So therefore really tzedakah is a preservative for a person's assets. That's why again it says v'yikholi tiruma. The Torah goes on to tell us the different furnishings that were needed for the Mishkan. The first was the Aron. The Torah tells us, we read it inside, and I quote, it's the first furnishing the Torah talks about. Va'asu Aron aseh shittim. And there's a reason why the Torah starts off with the Aron. What about the Mizbeach? What about the Shulchan? What about all the other vessels that we use? Why is the Aron the first object that the Torah discusses? What was this Aron? In English they call it the Ark. What was significant about the Aron? What was its significance? It housed the Luchot. The Ten Commandments that Moshe Rabbeinu brought down were in the Aron HaKodesh. But not only the Aron, the Ten Commandments that were the keepers, but even the ones that were broken, they collected the pieces, and they were also in the Aron, as well as a Sefer Torah that Moshe Rabbeinu wrote himself. And therefore the Aron symbolizes Torah. And we might say that it is indeed the centerpiece of the entire Mishkan, the Aron HaEdut. And its location is in the Holy of Holies. It's in the most prestigious position, right where the Kohen Gadol goes in once a year to pray for atonement for the Jewish people. That's where the Aron stands. And the reason why the Torah talks about the Aron first is to teach us a lesson. That whenever one embarks upon a project, it must be according to the principles of Torah. Even when it comes to building the Mishkan, it's got to be according to the Torah. What does the Torah say? What's the measurements? What's the halakha? Then that should be a lesson to everything. That any time a person is doing anything in his life, his guide and his light and his direction must come from the Aron. A person opens up a business. It has to be, again, before he makes any business decision, what does the Aron say? What's the proper way? What's the proper halakha? What's the best way to do the following business deal? Everything has to be starting point of foundation, the Aron HaKodesh. Once a person lives his life where the Aron is the centerpiece, then there's berakha in everything he does. But many people, they think they know better than the Torah. They want to do it their own way. And Chas v'Shalom, when one veers off the path of Torah, there's usually roadblocks. There's usually interference. And there's no beracha. And then the Torah says, you're starting to build the Mishkan before you do anything. The first thing is the Aron. First, you have to accept upon yourself the Torah's opinion. You have to accept upon yourself the halakha. You have to accept upon yourself God's view. Once you accept upon yourself the Aron, then already go forward. You'll have beracha. There's no problems. But I saw brought down from Hakamim, if you look at the measurements of the Aron was a box. It had measurements. The Aron was 2.5 by 1.5 by 1.5. It's not important for you to know exactly the measurements. You're not going to be tested on this. But the Torah tells us the measurements. Now there must be a reason. What do I have to know? What do I care how big the Aron was? It's like reading the blueprints of somebody's house. You see, the den is 10 by 12. What do you care about the measurements? But if the Torah is telling it to us, there must be a musar, there must be a lesson. And I saw from the Hakamim, they say, if you look at all the other furnishings, they're all whole measures. 2 by 1 by 1. The Aron, all its measurements are half measurements. 2.5 by 1.5 by 1.5. Why? What's the lesson? So I've said in previous years, because the Torah is teaching us that in order to succeed in studying Torah, in order to succeed in religion, in understanding of the Torah, one must be a half measure. One must have humility. The Torah only rests in a person that has a humble spirit. You see, the Torah is different than any other subject. If you want to be a great mathematician, you could also be very arrogant. It won't bother you. You could understand mathematics and have arrogance at the same time. A person wants to become a great scientist. He could also have gava, he could also have haughtiness. It will not affect him. As a matter of fact, some of the greatest scientists have been some of the most arrogant people as well. But if a person wants to succeed in learning, Torah only goes to people that have humility. It seems the Torah, which is divine wisdom, only rests in people that are modest. In people that are, like I said, anav. People are low-key. People are not braggarts. People are not boastful people. People that are not show-offs. People that don't broadcast themselves and promote themselves. God says the Torah is compared to water. You've heard this analogy many times. And I always understood, why is the Torah compared to water? Because water is an essential of life. You know, a person might be able to go 3 days or 4 days without eating. But at the end of the day, a person needs water before he needs food. That's more important. Water is the essential of life. The Torah is considered like water. To show you, physically you need water, the spiritual water is Torah. No Jew can go without learning. But now I see a different interpretation. We know something about water. It always seeks its level. Water always goes down to the lowest point. A person has a leak, and the leak is on the top floor. Where does it end up showing up? In the basement. That's the nature of water. It just keeps on going down and down and down till there's nowhere else for it to go. And therefore the Torah is compared to water to tell us, just like water always goes down, always goes to the lowest place, so too Torah can only be studied and learned and received by the lowest of people. Why did they compare Torah to wine? Wine is hashuv, wine is it's fancy. Water is simple and it goes down. There was once a great rabbi called Rabbi Yoshua. Rabbi Yoshua ben Hananya. Rabbi Yoshua was uncomely. He was not handsome at all. The Gemara says he didn't have a good look. So the daughter of the king once saw Rabbi Yoshua. And she tells Rabbi Yoshua, Chokhmah mefu'eret, bichli mechu'ar. Such glorious wisdom in such an ugly package. She was very candid. So Rabbi Yoshua wasn't offended. He said, your father, he has wine? Yeah, royal wine. Where does he keep the wine? Does he keep it in gold caskets? Or does he keep it in earthenware? So she says, I don't know, I'll go check. She comes back and she sees they keep it in earthenware. So she orders the messengers of the king, the workers of the king, the stewards, go change all the vats of wine, put them in gold. The next day the king asks for some wine. He drinks it, it's vinegar. He asks for another wine, vinegar. He says, what's going on over here? He goes into his winery. He sees somebody transferred all the wine into gold. He tells his daughter, who said to do this? So she says, Rabbi Yoshua. Bring Rabbi Yoshua. Rabbi Yoshua, you told my daughter to do this? I didn't tell her to do anything. She asked me a question. I answered her. What did she ask you? Just such glorious wisdom in such an ugly vessel? I said, look at your father's wine. The most delicious wine. Where do you keep it? In the most simple of caskets. Why? Because when you put wine in gold, it spoils. So the same thing. The reason why I have this glorious wisdom is because I'm humble. And he said, and if I was uglier, I'd be wiser. Which means that the humility of Rabbi Yoshua is what made him such a great scholar. I've said also on this subject that part of the humility and the simplicity of Torah, if you remember where the Torah was given on Har Sinai. Har Sinai is not a majestic mountain at all. As a matter of fact, if you look on the map, there are much more glorious mountains that the Torah could have been given on. I mean, we have in this country Everest and tall mountains like that, but even in that region, you have Hermon, which is a high mountain, you have the Tabor, you have Carmel. It's a very, very tall, beautiful mountains. Har Sinai is, it's more of a hill. And you wonder, such a prestigious Torah, historical book, should be given on, it's a generic mountain, Har Sinai. And the explanation is exactly, the Torah is given without fanfare. The Torah is given with modesty, with simplicity, not with a lot of noise, not with a lot of talk. That's where the greatness of Torah lies. And that's why Hachamim tell us all the measures of the Aron are half measures. 2.5. 1.5. 1.5. To show to succeed in Torah, you can't look at yourself as complete. A person thinks he's perfect, he's this. Torah's not for you. Torah only goes in people that are half measures. That people feel insignificant. People feel they have more to accomplish. People feel that they're not so great. People feel that they have deficiencies and therefore they have something to work on. Torah loves that person. The Torah goes into that person. Hanaba, that's why Moshe Rabbeinu was the greatest scholar. Why? Because he was the most humble. There's a direct connection between the humility of Moshe and his wisdom. Such a humble man becomes a keli, becomes a vessel to receive the entire Torah. That's what we said in previous years. But this year I want to say a new interpretation. Our Torah is different than any other subject. Any other subject, and I mean any other subject, has an end. A person is able to exhaust and study the entire subject and finish it. Even mathematics. A person go on to college and study higher mathematics and higher levels, but at the end he goes to the top class of quantum physics, and after he masters it, he gets what's called a master's. Finished. You've exhausted the subject, you know it all, it's finished, there is no next math book. Now, that doesn't mean to say that they might come out with a new article or a new finding, but basically, you mastered the subject. The subject is over. And everything is like that. Every subject, you're able to graduate, get a diploma, and it's over. Except Torah. A person never graduates from learning. You have to know that. Our Torah is endless and it is infinite. Those that don't learn think the Torah is very small. They wonder, what could you be learning all day? To them, they think the Torah is a few stories about Avraham Avinu, maybe the story of Noah and the flood, Akedat Yitzhak, a couple of laws. People come to me many times, Rabbi, you're still studying in the Kollel. What are you studying? You don't know it already? You didn't learn it? You didn't finish it? What are you doing exactly? To the simple mind, they think Torah is very small. But I want you to know, when we sit in the Kollel and study, the more we study, for every page we study, we realize that there's 100 more pages we don't understand. Because the more you open up the Torah, you realize it's endless. The Torah, you could never finish it. We read the same parashot every year. Why? Last year we read parashat Terumah. Why are we reading it again? We did it already. See, the Torah is studied even by the greatest hachamim. The same Torah is studied. Every single day, the same pesukim, the same concepts. And don't think it's stale. Don't think, okay, it's a review. Yes, they do review their learning. But every time you study Torah, there's more insights. So you tell me, remember, when does it end? It doesn't. Never ends. The Torah is a subject where there is no graduation. You never get to the point where you say, okay, I did it, I know it all, Hadran, Siyum, next subject. No, no. As a matter of fact, if you ever went to a Siyum, your husband's or your parents, whatever it may be, they made a Siyum on a Masechet of Talmud. There's two lessons you learn at a Siyum when they finish a tractate of the Talmud. Number one, right after they finish the tractate, the custom is they start the next one. That's the minhag. Why? Because we're trying to show everybody, you never finish. But let's say they finish the whole Talmud. What do you think they do on the last day when they finish the last page of the Talmud? They start again from the beginning. But you learned it already. We learned it. We read it once. Now we're going to read it again, and we're going to get more out of it. And you could study the same passage 100 times. The Beit Yishai, for example, if I'm not mistaken, on one pasuk in Tehilim, Poteach et yadecha umasbia lekol hay rason. We say it in Ashrei. He gave 150 interpretations. And that's only one pasuk. And trust me, after he gave the 150 interpretations, he didn't say, that's it. No, he said, I have 150. Maybe somebody else has another 300. The Gaon Mevilna, for example, on 3 words in the Torah, Pinu lachem safona, gave 1,280 interpretations. And that's only one man on three words. So you see, the Torah is an endless study. That's why. How do we refer to our scholars? Our scholars are called Talmidei Hachamim. Those are two contradictory terminologies. A Talmid is a student. A Hacham is a professor. In college, there's a professor and there's a student. There's no such thing as a student professor. Or professor in training. You're either a professor or you're a student. But in Judaism, the professor is a student and the student is a professor. Hence he's called a Talmid Hacham, because he's always learning. There's no such thing where you've finished. There's no such thing as you've done the subject and you've mastered it. You could know it well, but that's only one facet. Now what about all the other facets? Therefore, every student is a Talmid Hacham. You're always a student in Torah. And that's why, you ladies might not know it, but next time you have a chance and you see a Talmud, I'm not telling you to study the Talmud, leave that for the men. But the next time you take a Talmud and you look at it, I want you to open it up. And you'll find a lot of nice things in the Talmud, but there's one thing you're not going to find. Page 1. Every tractate of the Talmud starts on page 2. It's a funny thing. Always the first page of every Masechet is Daf Bet. And always that bothered me. You're starting a book. You start from page, isn't that simple? Isn't that logic? You start from Daf Aleph. Why, when the Talmud is written, they always start page 1, but they say you're on page 2 already? Because they want to remind the student, you never finished. There's always a page that you didn't do. There's always something that you don't know. Don't think when you learn, I learned the whole thing. You did Daf Aleph? There's no Daf Aleph. It means you didn't finish it all. You can never finish the entire Talmud. You can never finish all the Hedushim. And many times a person comes to Shi'ur. And, well, that's why the Torah says the measurements of the Aron are half measures. To show you, no matter how much you learn, it's still half. It's still not complete. You're never able to really get to the wholeness of the Torah. But then you have some people that come to a shi'ur and they hear an idea and they come along and say, I heard it already. It's a repeat. And they feel that they got shortchanged. I know that one already. I don't know. The rabbi's repeating his thoughts. He said that last year. He said that the year before. Well, is that a proper attitude? Well, somebody once asked me, and my initial answer to them was, you like music? Yes. I said, do you listen to the same song over and over again? Certainly. Why? You know it already. On the contrary, good music, everybody has their favorite song. Yeah, let's do it again. The Torah is not worse than music. A person goes to a restaurant. He always orders the same thing at the restaurant. Well, you had it already. I like it. This is what I like. The Divrei Torah is not worse than a menu. You hear the Divrei Torah, you hear it again, delicious. You can never have enough lollipops. You can never have enough candy. And you always like to have it again, especially the Divrei Torah you know already. And I want you to know something. That never is the Divrei Torah 100% the same. And I'll tell you why for a few reasons. Number one, usually when it's said over, the rabbi will add something, say something he didn't say previously, and if you're a good listener, you'll be able to catch a nuance. So it's really never the same. One time, I think the Hafetz Chaim was giving a shi'ur, so one of the students said after, he said this one last year, so his student, Rabbi Elchanan Wasserman, said, no, in this one he changed three words. He was listening so good, he was able to catch the nuances of the Divrei Torah. But there's another reason why the Divrei Torah is not the same. Even if it's word for word, like it was said, it's scripted, it's the same Divrei Torah. You read it. It was sent to you, the same Divrei Torah, 2 years in a row. It's exactly the same, there's no difference. But you're not the same. You understand? Whenever we hear Divrei Torah, it goes into us based on what's happening to us in our life. Based on the situations that we're in. Based on current events. Based on a million and one things. And therefore, Every Devre Torah that's brought to us at a given time enters our soul at a different angle. It hits us differently. Something that we were inspired from 1 year might touch us differently the next year. We might take a different message based on something that we're going through. And therefore there's never a repeat in Devre Torah. Every Devre Torah is fresh. Every Devre Torah is new. So we have to listen good in order to get the message. Shlomo HaMelech says in his Mishle, he says, Masir ozno mishemo haTorah, gam tefilato to'eba. He says, somebody that closes his ears from hearing Devre Torah, God despises his prayers. The Gaon Rabbi Eliyahu from Vilna said once, why is that the punishment? A guy comes to class, a lady comes to class, the rabbi starts to say Devre Torah, she leaves. God says, that person, I despise their prayers. Why do you despise their prayers? They're good people. Says the Gaon of Vilna. Because every day we pray to God the same prayer 3 times a day. It's the same exact tefillah, it's a repeat, and we repeat the same words over and over, and God listens. But once a Jewish person says, oh, I heard that one already, God says, I heard that prayer already also. And therefore, on the contrary, if we want our prayers to be answered, when a person hears the same Devre Torah, we have to get excited. Oh, good, I'm glad I was reminded of the Devre Torah. Good, I can hear it again. I'm able to hear good music, the same song again, the same food again. Good, now God will listen to my prayers. There's a benefit in the repetition. And that doesn't mean the rabbi should always repeat. But at least that's a musar on the listener that you should accept the repetition. And that's why the Aron is written in half measures. 2.5, 1.5, 1.5. You never finished. You always have more to go. However, the Shulchan was the table. The table in the Beit HaMikdash and the Mishkan had on it 12 loaves of bread. Lechem HaPanim. And if you look at the measurements of the Shulchan, it's all complete measures. It's 2 by 1 by 1. What's the message of the Shulchan? Why is the Shulchan complete measurement? Because the table represents parnasa. The table where it has the bread, that represents sustenance. It represents a person's living. Hakamim tell us that if a person wants to become wealthy, when he prays the Amidah, he should pray towards the east, but he should tilt a little towards the north, because the Shulchan was in the north of the temple. And that's where all the Berakha came down from the world, through the table, through the Shulchan, that's where the Parnassah is. So you'll see next time in synagogue, when you see somebody facing to the north, you know, he's praying also for Parnassah, which is okay. That's what the Shulchan represents. But our rabbis tell us it's complete measurements. Why? To teach us when it comes to your livelihood, whatever you have to feel it's complete. You have to feel content that whatever God gives a person, it's enough. That this is what it is. When it comes to Torah, you never can complete it. You have to learn and learn and learn, and whatever you learn, there's still more to go. But when it comes to Parnassah, it's 2 by 1 by 1. It's finished. It's complete. That a person shouldn't always have claims. I use a little more. I need a little more. There was one fellow, he was once talking out loud in front of the Hafetz Chaim. His friend asked him, how's it going with Parnassah? So he told his friend, it wouldn't hurt if I had a little more. So the Hafetz Chaim interrupted and said, who said it wouldn't hurt? How do you know it wouldn't hurt? Which means if God is giving you this amount, that's exactly what you need. Maybe if you'd have a little more, it would be detrimental to you. Maybe God said it would cause you to be spiritually neglectful. Maybe it would take you away from religion. You don't know. And therefore a person has to make a beracha, sha'asali kol surki. God, you provide me with all my needs. And whatever a person has, for some reason, that's what God wants him at that given point in time. God doesn't want everybody to be wealthy, and the wealthy man has his test also. And God gives the test to the middle person and to the poor person. And the Torah is telling you, whoever you are, Ezu Ashir, Asame'a Bihalko. I'm fascinated by this Mishnah. The Mishnah is telling, who's a rich man? Our Mishnah does not define wealth by decimal points. It doesn't define wealth by dollar signs. It doesn't define wealth by bank accounts. And I'm shocked, because every other dictionary defines wealth by assets, by value, by things, by stuff. Mishnah says, who is rich? Hasameyach b'chilko. Somebody that is happy with what he has. Very interesting. So wealth is not about money. Wealth is an attitude. Wealth is an emotion. I know people that have very little, but they're wealthy people. Because they're happy. They're content. They have a certain fulfillment. And I know just as many people that have a lot of money, wealth like Korach, but they're very poor people. Because they have no happiness. They're not fulfilled. They're still thirsty. They still have an endless desire. As a matter of fact, some of them have a miserable existence. And therefore, the Mishnah says, Ashiru, true wealth, is a state of mind. It's in the character of the person. Doesn't matter how much money he has. And the Torah is coming to tell us, when it comes to the Shulchan, it's complete. It's two by one, that a person should know, whatever I have, I have. You know, Yaakov Abinu once talked about his wealth. And Esav, his brother, also talked about his wealth. Two brothers made two comments. And these comments are very telling. The way Yaakov referred to what he had and the way Esav said it, two different worlds. Yaakov Abinu says, Yesh li kol. He says, I have everything. Esav comes along and says, Yesh li rav. I have a lot. World of difference. And I don't know who was richer. I don't have their statements. Who had more money in the account? But I know one thing. I know who was happy. Yaakov was happy. Who wouldn't be happy? I have everything. The person has everything. He's happy. And Esav, with all that he had, Yesh li rav, I have a lot. Which, what is he saying? With all his stuff, he's saying, I didn't get there yet. I still have the next plateau. I still have some more things to acquire. He was maybe monetary wealthy, but he was emotionally poor. He was destitute, Esav, because nothing can satiate him. Nothing's able to satisfy him. That's the Yesh li rav. And that's what the Torah tells. When it comes to the Shulchan, be happy. Complete measures. Whatever you have, it is what it is. If I may say just one word on this subject. In the past 24 hours, I had a big zechut, which I looked at as zechut, to bury my late grandfather, Alav Shalom Morzekini Yosef Ben Sarah. Zichrono Lebracha. I just came back just now from the airport. I was in Israel for a few hours fulfilling this great mitzvah. And when a person is faced with such a mitzvah to bury anybody, especially when you're burying an important member of your family, a righteous man, tzaddik, of course it reminds us all of the mortality of human beings, and it puts life in a very, very clear perspective. You know, Shlomo HaMelech was very wise. He was the wisest of all men. Shlomo HaMelech made a statement, and he said, it's better to go to a house of mourning than to go to even a party. And some people might get offended. What do you mean? What type of morbid person was Shlomo? Must have been a depressed person. Who wants to go to a house of mourning, especially if you have a choice to go to a wedding or to go to a house of mourning? And Shlomo is saying, it's better. Why? Because every person's end is the same. Nobody can escape his mortality. And therefore, a person unfortunately lives through life in a delusion. People think they're going to live forever. People think they're going to be healthy forever. Everybody lives in a state of imaginary denial. And nobody can understand that one day they are going to be faced also with an ending. And the only place where you're really able to get the message, it's not in a class. Because even in a class, it's hacky, it's talk. It goes in one ear, goes out the other, it's concepts, it's theory, it's philosophy. But a person goes to Bet Avil, then already you see it. Then already it's a rude awakening where you see that what life is all about. Then already you see a perspective, then already you see a clarity that it's not just about spending money and shopping and acquiring and running around and being jealous and competing and gossiping and playing cards and traveling. You start to understand that there's more of a reality to this world, and the reality of this world is Olam Abba. This world is fake. And when you have a chance to go see somebody, Chas V'Shalom, it's beracha, I don't say it's a beracha. In this case, to be buried in Yerushalayim Ir HaKodesh, it reminds you. It reminds you what the purpose of life is. That the only thing that goes with a person is his Torah mitzvot. Everything else is futile. Everything else is a waste. So Shlomo HaMelech says, go to Bet Avil once in a while. You'll do yourself a favor. It'll remind you of what most people forget. Most people are living in, they're living in fantasy land. They have no idea of these concepts. And I'll conclude, I only want to tell it to you now when it's fresh in my mind so I can convey you true feelings that we might forget, including the speaker. You get involved. The world's very confusing. And it doesn't. There's no signs that are written. Don't forget the purpose, don't forget the goal, Olam Abba. You can forget very easily what our mission is. Sof davar hakol nishma et ha'eluhim yirav et misvotav shemor ki zeh kol ha'adam. Shlomo HaMelech sums up the whole world in one phrase. Fear God, keep the mitzvot, and that's it. Everything else is interruption. Everything else is inconvenience. Everything else is bothersome, is a trouble, is a tirda. There was two people that spent a lot of time arguing on a piece of land. Ze omer kula sheli, ve ze omer kula sheli. They're both fighting. It's my land. It's my land. I have to tell you about people that get involved in these type of arguments. And to them it's very important. Again, a person that forgets his purpose in life will spend years arguing on something like a piece of real estate. So they went to the rabbi. So the rabbi said, I hear you. Could you show me which piece of land you're arguing about? So they see, it brings them to the plot. So one of the brothers says, the land is mine. And the other brother says, the land is mine. And the rabbi puts his ear, he says, let me ask the land. And he comes back and he says, the land says, both of you belong to him. And at the end, you're fighting over the land. The land owns you. At the end, everybody's under the land. The land's on top of a person at the end. You don't own, you're fighting over the land, says you're going to be mine in the end anyway. Both of you belong to me. And therefore the rabbi was trying to teach them, you want to waste your whole life fighting about the land, you're both going to end up in the same land that you're fighting about. What is it going to get you? Therefore a person has to, in life, if a person has mahloket, you're going to waste the whole life on mahlok. For what purpose? For what purpose? There's more important things to do. There's more important missions to accomplish. And that Bezat Hashem, everybody will live with the proper perspective, with the proper view. Like David HaMelech says, that after a person goes, the mitzvot will follow. He says, Lo b'moto yekach hakol. He can't take everything, but he can take something. And that's the Torah mitzvot. And Bezat Hashem, everybody will have Chaim Arukin, long life to all. And Bezat Hashem, he'll accomplish a mission. Amen.